Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to a city when its newspaper dies? As more and more American dailies struggle to survive declining ad revenues and hard copy readership, those who cherish newspapers are struggling to imagine what their absence might do to the communities they serve. Richard Rodriguez is an editor at New American Media in San Francisco. He explores his own notions of the value and purpose of local papers in the cover story for the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
You write here that we no longer imagine the newspaper as a city or the city as a newspaper. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, what I wanted to do in the Harper's piece was to try to describe what it was like to be a reader of newspapers. I've worked off and on. I've never been employed by a newspaper, but I've written for newspapers as op-ed writer and so forth. But what I was trying to do in this piece was try to describe what a newspaper, in this case the San Francisco Chronicle, had meant to me as a boy, as a teenager, as a young man, growing up, and how my sense of the city was formed through the newspaper. What was also the case in the San Francisco Chronicle's instance is that the newspaper took its meaning from the city. Most of the newspapers that are dying today, Chris, were born in the 19th century. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer, born in 1863, died 2009. The Rocky Mountain News, born 1859, died 2009. The Ann Arbor News, born 1835, died 2009. You have to imagine what America was like in the 19th century when these new towns and cities were being formed, the freshness of them, the sense of surprise that people had coming from different parts of the country, finding themselves in Seattle or in Denver, puzzled by the people that they who were suddenly their neighbors, and the function of the newspaper in such an instance was to describe the city to the city, was to help people understand what it was to live in Denver, what the sky meant, what the man down the block did, who died, who was born today, who was getting married next week, and so forth. The function of the paper was to describe the city to itself.
What can you find about a city if you've never been there before and the first thing you do is pick up a copy of its paper? What does it tell you?
Well, what it tells me is it tells me what kind of conversation the city is having or not having. I live part of my year in London now. The city has 9 newspapers, and in many ways there are different versions of London, each of the newspapers separated by class and by politics and so forth. But what you get from the newspaper is a sense of what the newspaper holds important and what's going on around it. And I don't mean simply the big news, the news about the Queen or the news about President Obama. I mean the small news. When I was born in San Francisco, that fact was recorded in the local San Francisco newspapers. It's obviously no longer the case that births are noticed in the paper, but neither, incidentally, are marriages noticed in many American newspapers that are dying. We've lost a sense of the texture of our daily lives. Instead, you know, what we have in newspapers is this perennial argument out of Washington about liberals and conservatives, and we're losing a sense of the 4-H club, of the state fair, of the want ad, of the department store ad, of the Neiman Marcus ad. If I had grown up in Dallas, I would have studied Neiman Marcus ad with some interest, not simply as a place, because my mother would probably never have shopped there, but a sense of the glamour of Dallas, the sense of the possibility of Dallas or Fort Worth. And in many ways, the advertisements on the page were as much a description to my young eyes as any news story could be.
Well, where does this come from? Is it a matter of newspapers really failing to sense the kinds of things that people wanted to read, or a matter of people just not caring what's in the newspaper?
Well, remember, this is a reciprocal relationship. Mm-hmm. I think in many ways, Americans have grown strange to each other. We're no longer curious about each other. We have invented this technology, a digital technology that allows us to voice our own opinions in response to anything, whether it's healthcare in Washington or a column we might read in the newspaper or the winner of American Idol. We're just chattering on constantly now with our own opinion. And we're not very interested in the stranger next door. I think when that happens, when Americans no longer knew each other and moved away from their hometown, I think something very large happened in the American consciousness. We no longer lived in the place that our newspaper lived in, and with that we started reading national newspapers, for example, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, and we no longer read. I have a friend who lives in Los Angeles. He grew up in Emory, Texas, and to this day, I think if Emory still has its newspaper, I think it was called the Orange County Leader. He would read that newspaper for news of the town that he'd grown up in. That's what the newspaper did. But obviously, David, as he moved from Emory to Los Angeles, lost that sense of immediacy, and it became a kind of curiosity, especially after his parents died, to stay in touch with Emory. And that tie has faded over the years and probably will die as a newspaper does.
Well, you know, Richard, it's interesting that you classified the Seattle Post-Intelligencer as among the dead, because, in fact, it does still publish news, but it's only online. There's no hard copy.
That's right.
What tells you that this is not just the sort of new evolution of newspapers and that it wasn't about the paper to begin with?
Well, for one thing, what's happened to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, as friends of mine will tell you, who worked at the newspaper, is that writers and editors have been fired, mm-hmm. or given early retirement. The staff has been radically reduced. And what we have online is basically a kind of skeletal version of what the newspaper used to be. So that in many ways, there is some, in the ether of cyberspace, there is some entity called the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, but it doesn't exist as a vibrant literary artifact. It's lost its writers. You can't have a newspaper without writers. You have headline services without writers. And that's what increasingly these online services are becoming.
Talk for a minute. You started reading the newspaper daily as a teenager, and Herb Cain's column was the first thing that you would turn to.
That's right. I grew up in Sacramento, California, I should tell you, and I was bored with Sacramento, California in those years. And I wanted a big city, and San Francisco was the nearest big city, and its climate was very different from the Central Valley of California, which was hot and dry. San Francisco's weather was foggy and gray, and I loved that notion of this very small city that was also very tall, and that had this arrogant sense of itself, which was provincial, but nonetheless paraded as a kind of cosmopolitanism. That San Francisco was the city it called itself. And what I loved about Herb Cain, who was the primary columnist in an era of columnists at the Chronicle, was that he described San Francisco to San Francisco. And he let those of us who didn't live in that city have a sense of the drama of the city, whether Danny Kaye was in town or whether someone famous was in the hospital and needed a card or the local scandal. His conversation was the gossip of the city. And to lose that voice, when we finally did lose him in the early 1990s, was to lose essentially a voice that cannot be replaced now. The Chronicle has no columnist of that intelligence and that wit who can invent San Francisco that way. You see what I'm saying is that the newspaper writer invented the city, and insofar as that invention seemed authentic to the reader, It was a relationship that was true.
And you could count on the fact that if you were waiting in line for a sandwich or waiting for a bus or something, that the person next to you had read the column and that could be a starting place for discussion.
That's right. And you also knew people. I mean, you know, Cain decided that he was then a rival in San Francisco with a columnist who spent a lot of time in Hollywood. Cain decided that he was not going to work the celebrity line. He was going to make celebrities out of, you know, the local jeweler or the local furrier downtown. And we came to know these people, and he gave them names, and sometimes they were derogatory, but sometimes they were just humorous names. But we followed them, the nightclub entrepreneur, the topless dancer. We knew these people over time. He peopled our world the way all, I think, great columnists do.
Based on your experiences in Northern California, your piece specifically looks at the history of the news business in San Francisco, and there's certainly a lot of colorful detail there. Can you talk for a minute about how what is now the San Francisco Chronicle came into existence?
The San Francisco Chronicle came to, into existence largely with the birth of the city. It's a family of with three teenage boys came to San Francisco in the 1860s, when San Francisco was a gold rush city. These were teenage boys, I stress, and what they decided to invent, as the city around it was around them was inventing itself, was to invent a daily dramatic chronicle. A newspaper that was concerned with the opera going on. There were three or four opera houses at the time, with the theaters, with the saloons, with the melodeons, with the circuses, all the entertainments that these young men who were coming to San Francisco from all over the world, all these entertainments that these young men needed was in the Daily Dramatic Chronicle, and they gave it away. It was one of those freebies that we get now in almost any city in the world, that are. Essentially, entertainment magazines. What the Chronicle did is that it had to reinvent itself as the city reinvented itself, as the city became more sober, literally, as those young men became workers within the city, as the city became a banking city, as a city became a shipping port, as a city became a place of commerce. The Chronicle was no longer simply engaged with the business of entertainment, but it became a newspaper in all of the chapters that a city has, because that's exactly what the city is doing. The city is constantly rewriting the newspaper. So what you have now, Chris, is if you tell me that a newspaper is dying in America, I will tell you that it is not the newspaper that is dying alone. It is the city that is dying. A sense of what it means to live in Emory, Texas. The sense of what it means to live in Denver, Colorado, is diminishing, and we're spending all of our time listening to Rush Limbaugh, we're at airports listening to CNN headline news, and going to another airport where the CNN headline news is blaring, or we are waking up at a motel in Des Moines, Iowa, and outside of our hotel door is USA Today, which was published where? In nowhere. And doesn't exist in any place, but rather tries to keep up with us as we move from place to place.
Well, you know, that's such an interesting thing to think about, Richard, because, you know, it occurs to me that we do travel so much. You mentioned watching CNN in the airport lounge. So many people are so mobile that I wonder if they are seeking a sense of place that crosses hundreds and thousands of miles.
I think the reverse. I think we're trying to avoid place. You know, a lot of times in America, we talk about ourselves in the passive construction. We say that the automobile changed, the Model T Ford changed our lives. We say that the birth control pill changed the way we have sex. We invented the birth control pill. We invented the Model T Ford. Now we say, well, the computers are changing the way we are processing information. We invented the computer. The question is, why did we invent the computer? Why do we want to know information this way? Why do we not want anymore to hold paper in our hand? Holding paper in your hand is to exist in a specific time and place. When I hold paper, as I'm doing right now, this is a physical act, it's a sensual act. To get my information in a paperless world is to move beyond sensory experience. Is to move into some new territory of relationship to information. But it's important to say that we invented this technology. The question is why.
Richard Rodriguez is my guest. He's an editor at New American Media in San Francisco. His article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is an editor at New American Media, Richard Rodriguez. His new article in the November 2009 issue of Harper's Magazine is called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Richard, if we are, as you say, avoiding a sense of place, is it a matter of running from something that makes us uncomfortable or something else drawing us away?
Or are we running towards something?
Yeah.
That I cannot not answer. I think that there is this restlessness in America that I've always admired, this kind of loony quest to keep moving. What results, of course, is this vast loneliness in America. We are such a lonely people. Heartbreakingly so, and Thoreau knew that, in the 19th century. But there is also with that loneliness, there's this inventiveness that Americans have. That's the good part, that we keep reinventing ourselves. We ended up in a place like Las Vegas that knows nothing about us, and we change our names, lose weight, become bodybuilders. Change our hair color, remarry, and in that there is this constant optimism of the country, but it's an optimism that teeters always on a kind of sadness. What the newspaper was connected to, of course, and Herb Cain, you mentioned in San Francisco, was connected to the notion that San Francisco was like no other place, and San Francisco's provincialism fed that notion. What you have now with the Chronicle, for example, is that most of its columnists live in the suburbs. They no longer live in that place called San Francisco. Maybe with that movement of people away from Dallas into the suburbs, maybe when the Dallas Cowboys moved into the suburbs, maybe when Neiman Marcus moved into the suburbs, maybe when that specificity of place is diminished, that we no longer need the conversation with that place. In that case, of course, what you have is that kind of amorphous sense that we all live on a strip mall, and that there is no information about the people surrounding us at Kmart or at Walmart that we need to know. We don't want to know who they're getting married to. We don't want to know their high school graduation stories. We don't want anything about them, except we're vaguely interested in sort of each other as poll numbers, how many Americans are in favor of the war, of pursuing the war in Afghanistan, what percentage. But beyond that, we really are not asking very intimate questions about one another.
Hmm. It strikes me, Richard, that at least in this market, the thing that, if anything, is taking the place of that role for the hard copy newspaper, it is these hyper-local blog sites, including some that are actually run by the local papers, and the columnists sort of communicate in that way. What keeps us, if we still have some desire to communicate in this way, from fighting for the newspaper?
Well, I think in some ways these hyper-local blogs you're describing are filling some essential need that we have, but they're also, I find them a little bit too segregated to challenge the traditional role of newspapers. The newspaper traditionally had the role of describing the city to the city, its various neighborhoods, its various quarters. That sense of the city entire, that is, that we would write about neighborhoods that we no longer, that we didn't necessarily live in, but were part of our daily life. That sense of that city is giving way to a sense of a very specific look at these blogs. The demographic of them, in most cases, is either racially or in terms of age or in terms of economics or education, is pretty specifically defined. And in that sense, it doesn't quite fulfill for me the largest notion of a great metropolitan paper, which is to write about something larger. I begin my essay with a description of a friend of mine who is now 97 years old, and she lives in California. And she had grown up in North Dakota, near the Canadian border, and she learned to read from the Chicago Tribune, the Sunday edition of the Chicago Tribune, which would come out Wednesday at the latest. And her teacher would read to the students various parts of the Chicago Tribune. Now, they didn't live in Chicago, but the magic of that process of reading the Chicago Tribune was for my friend, who is now 97, the basis of what she understood a newspaper to be. It was like reading a Dickens novel. You were introduced to Victorian London. You were introduced to 19th century Chicago. She remembers a detail on one Sunday paper, the detail about the women in Chicago going to the opera, and the photograph of, or the drawing of women in Chicago going to the opera in sleeveless gowns. And that detail furnished for her a whole mythos of what it means to live in Chicago, not North Dakota. For many of us, you know, invariably now, you mentioned how much we travel. When I go to, say, Boston or Cleveland or Dallas, and someone at the hotel desk, they said, do you want the local paper tomorrow at your door, or do you want the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal? I always say the national paper, because I'm losing that interest in Dallas and Cleveland and Boston. I no longer have a sense that they exist. And so in many cases, I don't even bother with them anymore. I live in this amorphous world of the New York Times.
Is that only a loss, or is there some benefit to be gained from that?
Well, you'll have to tell me the benefit. I guess I know a great deal about what's going on in New York. The New York Times, by the way, and the Wall Street Journal, because they begin to sense the decline of the Chronicle, have just within the last month started San Francisco editions. Both papers have started San Francisco editions. And that is that it's rather like the New Yorker has a California columnist. He lives in Brooklyn, and he writes about California from Brooklyn. Because New York fondly is not interested in California. It really isn't. They're not interested in, maybe they're interested in a little swath of Beverly Hills, but that's about it. And finally, so what we get in the Wall Street Journal, we got it today, what we get in the New York Times on Tuesdays and Fridays, is a page or two of absurd California or Bay Area news. This a national newspaper that is trying to impersonate a local newspaper. That's what we'll get. We'll get little features like that. I used to work on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and for PBS. I worked on that show with that show for 18 years, and the decision was recently made to get rid of the essayist, which had been on the show for 25 years. A large number of essays got produced by that show, I think 1,500. The function of the essay in that case was to give a sense of the local, because all this news in New York and Washington, especially when Robin McNeil was on the show, the great news of the great world, was somehow moderated with this concluding note, the solitary voice in Ohio talking about the first snowfall of the year. And that notion that the news is not simply global or epic, but the news is also intimate and close, was what the essays gave. Well, the decision was made on the show that the essays, even though they were the most popular part of the show, were to be discontinued at the same time that the show instituted a web page. So now you can talk to the NewsHour 24/7. You can respond. You can chatter on your computer. And lost is that sense. There was a wonderful writer whose name I forget now. He wrote for our Kansas City newspaper. He used to write these strange stories about these museums in Nebraska. You know, these tiny little one-room museums. Somebody had gone to Europe in the 19th century and opened this museum with all the artifacts that they brought back. The museum was open like once a day. And it was this wonderful and absurd sense that America didn't exist simply in Washington, but it existed in this corner of Nebraska. You know, that's what's lost.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Richard Rodriguez is my guest. We're talking about the essay that appears in the current issue of Harper's Magazine called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. Let's go on the phones to Frank in Dallas. Hello, Frank.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Oh, I'm enjoying the discussion with Richard Rodriguez and agree with him, you know, about the twilight of the American newspaper, but I don't think all is lost. The Dallas Morning News, and I've lived here most of my life, has gone to including these sections that address the particular part of town that you live in. And so there is some attempt, I think, to recreate that sense of community that I think you're talking about feeling lost. In the same way that when I flip open the New York Times, you know, you can read that section on just what's going on in New York City, and you feel like you're in New York City, you know, what's going on in this borough and that borough. So I was going to say it's not all gone, but at the same time, literacy or the enjoyment of reading as a literary society, I think no one's going to argue that that's declined. In fact, you know, there's several books out, including Idiot America, you know, that recently came out by Charles Pierce. I would recommend is perusing that. But it's just that where people have switched to this instantaneous soundbite and visual imagery thing, and they don't read anymore, and they don't know how to think linearly, basically, and there's a problem with it.
Yeah.
At the same time, I wanted to also...
Just as briefly as you can, if you would, Frank. Thanks.
Okay, to say something about the Kindle and the electronic reading devices, and I think in a way that that's going to advance all of those who love reading, whether they're colloquial or worldwide, and will save the rainforest. So I'm not really sad to see paper disappear.
Mm-hmm. Frank,
and that comment.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your call. What do you think, Richard, about things like the Kindle that are offering papers, and you can subscribe and you have to pay for this, but it comes to you not in paper?
Well, I've always loved reading books as text, the artifact of a book. I also, as a Christian, I also, as someone within the Abrahamic traditions, have been influenced by Judaism and by Islam to believe in the sacredness of text as artifact. That a book is a page, and that the wonder about America was that it wrote itself literally into existence. I describe America as the Gutenberg nation. What we're having now with the new media is something really kind of scary. I mean, those kids who walk down the street with either on their cell phones or plugged into their own sounds, who may or may not be talking to someone else, but who in some important way are talking to themselves all the time. If you look at them, they never look at you because they're not there. The young woman who is plugged into this digital communication system gets mowed down by a bus because she doesn't hear it. You can sit next to these people on streetcars, and there is no sense in which that they're there. When you have a generation of young people who are being encouraged toward a technology that displaces them, there is no way those children are going to read newspapers. It's whether the Dallas Morning News tries valiantly to resurrect a sense of neighborhood. The kids who are growing up in these neighborhoods don't live there; they live in their own space. The cafes that the Chronicle used to be distributed to in the 19th century. I went to a cafe very, very similar to one of those 19th century cafes recently. It's on Noe Street, just near Marcus Street in the Castor District. Inside was a group of men, each of whom were sitting at a computer. They had brought their own laptops to a cafe. I guess it was the Wi-Fi that brought them to the cafe, because there they all were. There was no sound in the cafe. They were all reading their own computer. There was one man who was looking at this video game of a kind of dog running across a field. I came into the cafe. I ordered my drink. The espresso machine went, I got my drink. I left, and not a sound was made. That was not where the San Francisco Chronicle was distributed in the 19th century. It was distributed in a noisy, boisterous a cafe of people talking to each other. That's gone. People are listening to their own sound.
Richard Rodriguez is my guest. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Tambor in Dallas. Hi, Tambor.
Hi. I'm jumping into this conversation and regrouping with what you were speaking about earlier. I'm curious, when you talked about us losing the sensory experience of communicating, from my point of view, watching my 14-year-old daughter on an iPhone and also using an iPhone for business, I'm not so sure if we're running away from things or if we're bringing things to ourselves and creating our own kind of conversation. And it ties into what you were just saying about talking to ourselves and no more noise. Maybe it's just white noise. It's more of a visual thing. We don't talk necessarily in a community, but we're creating our own communities, and rather than running from, these devices are bringing communities to us. And I'm just curious to see what you think about that.
Thanks for your call.
Gabriel, I like that. I mean, I quote a friend of mine who tells me that maybe the sense of place is outdated in America. He says that, you know, that he still reads a newspaper, but it's clipped and forwarded in bits and pieces on email during the day. A story from the New York Times, a piece from Salon, a blog from the Huffington Post, something from the Times of India, something from YouTube. It's like, he says, a giant newspaper being assembled at all hours from every corner of the world, still with news, but no roots in a place. And he says maybe we don't need any place anymore, because we have this vast network of sources coming to us. If that's the case, if we don't live in Dallas, Texas, if we don't live anymore in San Francisco, and we're sort of plugged into this international system, that's what's happening, and we should at least acknowledge that. We should not say that newspapers are dying. We should say that the sense of living in Dallas, Texas is dying. That's my only point.
Do you think we've traded that for a sense of living in the United States or in the world?
Well, I think some people live in the United States and some people are living in the world right now. Certainly, you know, you go down the street with some of these people and they're plugged into, you know, they're looking on their iPhone at photographs of some relative's wedding in Recife, Brazil, or they're listening to their grandmother in Mexico, or they're plugged into punk music from Glasgow, Scotland. In some way, they're living in a world, but they're also living in a tiny world of their own making, which is not exactly the world. The world normally, as its experience in flesh and blood, is something that comes to us, not something that we manufacture.
Richard Rodriguez is my guest. He's an editor for New American Media. We're talking about his article in the current issue of Harper's called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Rodriguez of New American Media in San Francisco. He's written the cover story for the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Red Oak and speak with Herschel. Hello, Herschel.
Yeah, hi.
I go right ahead, please.
A couple of things. I mean, this is a very complex situation. A lot of it has to do with economics to some extent, but I'm a big fan of the printed word. I love holding a newspaper in my hand and getting newsprint on it and sitting there drinking a cup of coffee with my eggs and toast in the morning and being able to lay it down when I need to, come back, pick it up, and whatever the deal is. Just the physicality of touching something that's tangible rather than something that's online or whatever the deal is means a lot to me, plus the fact that, you know, the thought process into putting something in printed form is much more thoughtful than just writing a blog on the internet or whatever, and also the journalistic ethics and so forth that were involved in newspapers, you know, several years ago. But from the economic standpoint, let me say one thing. Papers for a long time have been disparaged. They were called fish wrappers, birdcage liners, whatever the deal is. But from an economic standpoint, what the Dallas Morning News has done is the fact that they had a number of different sections that were specific. They had a science section on Wednesdays. They had Thursdays. They had a religious section on Saturdays. They had their cooking section on Wednesdays and so forth. They've reduced all that. They've combined a lot of the sections now. They have classified car sales in the sports section, which they didn't have before. and then they're charging three times what they were charging just 2 years ago for a monthly subscription. And I understand why they're doing it, but there's a number of reasons why newspapers are fading away, and it's not just because of the Internet. There's other economic reasons as well, and I'd like to hear a comment on that.
Thanks, Herschel.
I think that's all. I agree with all of that. I love what Herschel says. You ask people about what they love about reading a newspaper, and they'll often mention coffee or the taste of toast or eggs and so forth, that it's a very sensual experience. I was a newspaper boy in Sacramento. I carried the Sacramento Bee, and I know the weight of newspapers, and I know the touch of the color of ink on my hands when I was wrapping those newspapers and delivering them to various houses. I think that it's important at the same time that we acknowledge the kind of tightening of budgets at newspapers and the way now newspapers are in some sense killing themselves, as Herschel implies, that these papers are shrinking and are no longer economically worth buying. At the same time, I think we have to say, to get back to Herschel's first point about the sensuality of a newspaper, that what's replacing it is something very spooky. I think I mentioned in my piece a friend of mine who lives here in San Francisco. Craigslist is headquartered in San Francisco, as is Twitter. These two fantastically successful new technologies of connection. Well, he says he gets his sex on Craigslist all the time. It's instantaneous. There are people messaging each other on freeways saying, you know, I'm on this interstate. I'm free for sex, you know, on my way home. And he says the sex is really great, he says, although I think from some recent experience in Boston of a woman who found her sex on Craigslist and was murdered for it. He says the trouble is that these people will come to your apartment, the sex will be really great, almost silent, he says, and then they'll disappear before you can even get their email address or their first name. It's gone. There is some connection, I would like to argue, between the way we're receiving information about one another in this ether of cyberspace and the fact that we are no longer able to have a sensual experience with one another, that there is this odd sense of weightlessness to the entire world we're living in, so that not only is our information weightless in cyberspace and we're saving all these forests, But our sense of intimacy is becoming weightless, which is why pornography, of course, is the largest business we conduct on the Internet.
You quote the mayor of San Francisco here as saying that if and when the San Francisco papers vanish, people under 30 will not even notice. And I wonder if you think that given that and given the dangers of the kind of communication and generational gap that could pose, if we need to be searching for something else where we can all come to find and share information, or if we need somehow to make sure that they come back to the same places that we're reading.
I think when Linda Winslow, who's the executive producer of the NewsHour, told me that the essays were being discontinued, she told me that basically what they're looking for is a young audience. They're afraid that they're losing, that the audience that they have on a show like that, which is a serious, sober news show, is losing young listeners and young viewers. And so that they're going on the web looking for those people. In some sense, maybe that's what we're going to all end up doing, looking for each other on the web. But, you know, I was just listening to your commercial break, and there was the commercial break for Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor. And I thought, you know, the wonderful conceit of that show is that it comes from this mythical town, you know, in Minnesota, and that the pleasure it gives people in St. Paul, Minnesota, is this Lutheran village of eccentrics and domesticity that doesn't exist, you know. In many ways, you know, even that illusion may pass the younger listeners by, because they're not even going to know what we were sentimental about, because the suburb they grew up in looked a lot like the suburb in some other part of the country, with the same stores and the same music and the same MTV and the same flavorlessness that now engages us. I don't know whether Prairie Home Companion has a future, because its very premise that we could be sentimental about a lost home may be as much dated as the American newspaper.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Nevada. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What an absolute jewel of an interview, and thank you for having it. This is a very complex issue, and I love that you quoted Thoreau. I think Thoreau would say of our iPodded, interneted age that it costs more than it comes to. But, I've been connected to the Internet since long before it was called the Internet. And in a way, it has been good in that within my fields of interest and my bailiwick, I'm connected to people and have been for decades now all over the world within my field that share my interest. And I've come to know people all over the world that I would never have had a chance to meet in any other way. And some of us have become close, quite close friends. We speak of family and all that sort of thing. Yet, when you step back from that and look at it, I will never look in this person's eyes. I will never hold their hands while they grieve a loss. We have become, in a sense, raised to one another. We're disembodied spirits. And if you step back even further and look at the society at popular television, popular culture, you see that we're all becoming raised to one another. We're becoming little disembodied people who are only connected in our own narcissistic self-interest. And it seems like the entire culture is moving this way. Perhaps the loss of the newspapers is a symptom of a shift that's going on in general. And I'll listen to your response.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'd like that very much. I mean, that is my experience, too. I probably joined the Internet much after David did. I have people all over the world that I'm in regular communications to. Because I've written some books that are assigned in schools a lot, I get email from students. I don't know how they find my email, my email address, but somehow they find it on term paper nights, and I'll get these odd email requests, like, Dear Dick, they'll say, can our teacher assigned your book, and it's a very good book, they'll say, with all the cynicism appropriate, irritation, and they'll say, here's the question she's asking us, what do you think, And I think to myself, this is really something, One, the informality of that. I mean, I would never, as a student in high school, for example, have approached an author with that question, what does your book mean? That the Internet allows us that kind of informality of address. We're just able to talk to each other with that kind of freedom. But the problem, of course, is that, as David was suggesting, that there is no sensuality to that meeting. My brother, since this is relatively anonymous and he won't hear this show, he spends a lot of time talking to this group of eight men, and they argue about politics, and he's sort of the liberal in the group. And he says once in a while they might be coming through town, and he'll meet them and so forth, and he's formed a kind of cyber friendship with them. But it's all engaged in this kind of argument. That's the quality of their relationship. In the meantime, his wife has left him, and there is this weird sense that we're having this conversation with somebody in Glasgow, and the woman upstairs is weeping, and the son is playing video games, and the newspaper somehow belongs to that drama, because next door they're doing the same thing, and all up and down the block. And then we say, the headline says, well, The Seattle Post-Intelligencer has closed. And we say, oh, well, that was economics. It wasn't economics at all. It was that the wife was weeping and that the husband was on the Internet arguing about Obama with somebody that he either has met once or he'll never meet.
I wonder if you think this sort of impersonal nature of our relationships and this homogenization is ultimately a regrettable but necessary confluence of the progress we've made as Americans in not stratifying ourselves according to things like race and religion, taking a more egalitarian look at whoever another human being is, as opposed to automatically putting them in a category.
I think that's the best argument that can be made. But, I grew up reading books, and I grew up at the city library reading novels about people who were not like me. I grew up reading about African Americans, for example. I remember reading James Baldwin's book, Nobody Knows My Name, which was about growing up in Harlem. And I thought to myself, I mean, that's what a book did for me. It gave me that very procedure of moving beyond myself to other parts of America. It also was a library book, which means that its pages were well worn and sometimes stained mysteriously, and there was often a smell on those pages, and you always knew when you were reading that other hands had moved those pages, and that there was a sense not only of connecting with James Baldwin, but connecting with other hands that had also met James Baldwin. Mm. So it was this intense social act in this very private moment of reading. And I don't think anything we do right now can rival in its intensity that particular notion of the American forming a sense of Americans around him.
You close the piece, Richard, talking about the fact that the three papers you take every day are getting thinner and thinner, and there's less content and they're less compelling. I wonder if now, as you read newspapers and imagine that their complete demise is somewhere down the foreseeable horizon, if it becomes in some ways like dealing with a loved one who is sort of chronically and terminally ill, if you can't even fully enjoy them now because you know that the end is in sight.
Yeah, no, I have a loyalty to my friends who are dying. I say in my piece that, you know, the four friends of mine who died recently in San Francisco, none of them wanted to have their obituaries in the newspaper. Mm. Already that tells you something. The people are not imagining death as a city anymore. And all of three of the four wanted to be cremated. They did not want to be in cemeteries. They no longer wanted to be part of the city of the dead. And I say it in my piece that maybe the cemetery is as dated now in America as the newspaper, because no longer are we dying in common. When one of my best friends died, I'd met at his deathbed a friend who had known him from childhood. He couldn't attend the funeral, and he emailed me and said, "Where is Al's body?" So he could go visit. And I said, "I don't know." Al was cremated. He gave his ashes to two friends of his, and they took it somewhere. It may be under a tree. It may be in the ocean. It may be in a forest somewhere. We no longer die in a place anymore. And that tells you as much as anything about just how we are moving beyond our bodies into some other America that will never exist.
Richard Rodriguez is an editor at New American Media in San Francisco. His article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is called Final Edition, Twilight of the American Newspaper. Richard, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.